And hello, everybody. This is Chuck Horton from Double Cross Radio, coming to you live from the state of Jefferson. And tonight, we'll wish you all I hope you all had just a real happy Thanksgiving and spend some time with your family. And this show tonight is going to be so good that we will be able to use it for Thanksgivings many, 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 many years into the future, because it's going to, and it'll be kind of like, you know, that movie Christmas Story where the little kids out there is, you'll put your eye out. And, you know, that's a great movie. It's just kind of a Christmas classic that you see every year. But you still want to watch it because it's really good. We're hoping that this is this good. If it isn't, we're going to make a different one for next year. But, that's the goal. Tonight, it's all about Thanksgiving. And some of you may have heard, Rush Limbaugh talk about the real story of Thanksgiving. And he's a pretty good storyteller, and he does a pretty good job of getting, I mean, he doesn't say anything in his story that's untrue, but it's kind of an incomplete story. He's trying to illustrate a point, and he didn't do anything wrong. He illustrated his point very well, and we're going to illustrate the same point here, but there's a lot more to the story than just that. So we want to talk about the whole picture as much as we have been able to uncover and, research this week, actually in the last 2 weeks. And to start off with, I'm going to tell you about three of the books that were our primary reference material. And these books are not just about this subject. This subject is covered in chapters in the books. They're excellent books. The best one is a book by Thomas DiLorenzo. It's called How Capitalism Saved America. It's the untold history of our country from the pilgrims to the present. And well, of course, the pilgrims, that kind of gives you a hint. There might be something in there about the first Thanksgiving. And there is. But it's really, it talks about all of the first colonists that came to America. And they all had some of the same problems. I mean, and he does a really good job of describing how their economic situation was such that it made survival really tenuous. And I explain why. And really clear, easy to understand. And, you know, he's an economist and a historian, but he doesn't fill you up with a lot of jargon. It's not hard to understand. He gives you quotes from their actual diaries so you can see that, yeah, that's really what was happening. This isn't someone's opinion. This is a quote from the William Bradford's journal that he wrote in every day. And it's a fabulous book. It has other great chapters in it. I'm going to just tell you some of the things that it covers here real quickly. Oops, I went past the table of contents. Turning pages too fast. Okay, it talks about the robber barons. It talks about the Great Depression. It talks about the New Deal. It talks about capitalism how there's been kind of a war against it. It talks about antitrust myths. It talks about a lot of the things that happened during the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century and how the kind of the news has been filtered down to us or kind of reached us at this point in time in our history isn't really a complete story of that either. And it kind of ignores the official story kind of ignores what the real thing that was going on was present there. And so we've kind of, they've used that to justify laws that they've put in place that really are strangling our economy in one way or another. And so that book I really recommend for everybody to read. It's really easy to read. Thomas DiLorenzo is a great storyteller, and don't underestimate his intelligence. He's a brilliant man at the same time, but he can write in a style that everybody can understand. You don't have to be an economist to get this stuff, and it's not so complicated that it's way over your head. But I'd really recommend that book. It's really interesting. It'd be a great Christmas present for somebody. Once again, the title is How Capitalism Saved America. Thomas DiLorenzo has written some awesome books, and that's one of them. The second book, which is probably a little more of a probably more for people a little more into economics, has a little more jargon in it, and you have to understand a few concepts. He's not going to stop and break down and explain them to you when he's taught, you know, when he's making a discussion. So this may require a little more getting some other books and along with you when you read this and looking stuff up and understanding the concepts he's talking about. And it might take you a little longer to read, but it is really, really a fabulous book. And it's not, again, it's not just about the pilgrims. It's about the noblest triumph. It's what the name of the book is. The noblest triumph is about the concept of property rights through history. And it's just, this is one of, if I was going to leave and I had to go somewhere, and I could only take 5 books with me, this would be one of the books I would take. That's how good a book it is. Okay, and this book, you got to read it. I mean, it's not something you can just sit down and, oh, it's a kind of a cold rainy day. I'm going to sit down here in the chair with a blanket wrapped around me and read a good book. It's not that kind of book. You have to sit and focus, and your mind starts racing with all these ideas it stimulates, and it's very difficult to stay focused on the words on the page because it opens up a lot of new ideas in your mind. And I found that it was a fabulous book to read. But here's the chapters. It's actually in sections. The first section says first things, and he talks about the blessings of property, property law, and economy. And those are the two parts of the first section. The second section is called the free rider problem, and that's a problem with any collectivist type economic organization, whether it be socialism, communism, or fascism. There's always going to be a free rider problem. And so to illustrate that, he used the early settlers in the North American continent, Jamestown and at Plymouth Rock. And that, of course, is the Pilgrims, which is part of our Thanksgiving story. So that a lot of good information came out of there. And then he talked about the logic of the commons, which is why the commons doesn't work. Common system, if there isn't any ownership of the property, then it becomes to people who are using it as that it is a boundless resource. There's no scarcity to it, and they want to, or if they do realize there's scarcity, they want to use it up, but their share or as much as they can before there's no more left. So it becomes kind of stripped of all its value. And that's in the second section. The third section is called Romans and Common Law, the Status to Contract, and this talks about the importance of law or contracts for, I don't know how to say this exactly. It's a necessary, it's like part of a three-legged stool for an economy. You have to have property rights, and you have to have law. You have to have when someone says, I want you to make this for me and I'll give you so much money when you deliver it to me,
when you go ahead and make it and deliver it and they don't have the money, well, you have to enforce that contract. If there's no enforcement of contracts, then people can take advantage of you. So a contract makes someone honorable. It allows people to work with a something that they're going to get paid for in the future with a reasonable idea to be paid. Very important. Talks about a lot of things that didn't work, like Robert Owens' Trinity of Evils. Robert Owens, the guy, was kind of an idealist, set up some utopian societies. Talks about rights and property rights in another chapter. Why isn't the whole world developed property in Araby? Why did Ireland starve the Great Potato Famine? Intellectual property, which we've talked about, and I don't agree with everything he says in there, but boy, there's sure a lot of great information in there on that one. And I think the stuff that I don't agree with are really the minor things. He really lays out a lot of the same problems that we were talking about a couple of weeks ago in our intellectual property show. And then talks about a new beginning and how property rights being instituted anywhere in the world lead to a huge advancement in the prosperity of that nation, and uses the recent development of China as an example. And let me tell you, people, the property rights that have been expanded in China are by no means as good as anywhere else in the world, but they are so much better than what they had before that they, the people that they were opened up to, which would be like kind of a privileged class, it still resulted in a huge, huge expansion of their economy. And it was just a limited amount of increased property right freedoms. And he goes through all the statistics for that. And then the third book we used, by the way, that one's The Noblest Triumph. It was by Tom Bethel. It was written in 1998. It's very current. It's a great book. The third book is called The Light and the Glory. And it was written in 1977 by two men, Peter Marshall and David Manuel. Peter Marshall is the son of the former chaplain for the U.S. Senate. And this book is more of a... these two guys were looking for things which were relevant to a religious founding of the United States, or that this country was founded as kind of like a providential thing, or was an answer to a prayer by God, or something along those lines. And they probably stated in better words than I'm trying to right here in the book. But this is kind of from a religious standpoint, point of view, and so they leave out a lot of the economic stuff. But it's still, they have a very accurate and good descriptive picture of what it was like for the pilgrims prior to coming to America and after they came here. And, well, I think they kind of soft pedal some of the failures of their economic system, because they came over here as basically the Mayflower Compact, although it was earth-shattering, and it was the first time that men had stated unequivocally that they had the right to govern themselves. That was earth-shaking, but it was kind of, it had a lot of collectivist ideas in it, and it was kind of filtering over, I think, from their religious beliefs. But they found that those weren't really working very well, and they threw them out. We'll get into that. But this book is fabulous. Chapters 5 and 6 in this book deal with the pilgrims, or the separatists, as they were called. And we're going to talk about that in just a few seconds. So I want to give you some of the other chapters that are in here. There's the Christ Bearer. That was talking about Columbus. If Goldby, You're Almighty. They're talking about the coming for the... there's supposed to be gold here in the New World. We talk about the Puritans. We talk about the famous thing, A City Upon a Hill, and where that comes from. They talk about a lot of the different things that come in. They even get into the, just prior to the Revolution, how the church was really instrumental in filling the ranks of the Continental Army resistance. And there really was that was one of the freedoms that, I guess, the when a lot of people came here to worship as they wanted to, and it looked like England was going to start to take control of stuff and impose church rule back on everybody. A lot of the churches were very supportive of the Revolutionary War because they knew that their goose was cooked if they didn't win, that they would no longer be, they would be back in the same pot they were back in England where they were chased around fighting. And we'll get into that a little bit more as we go along. But this also is a good book, although I think for those of you out there that are really pretty strong Christians, you'll get a lot more out of this than the people who aren't. It really is there's a lot of things in here that they bring up that really kind of help you to strengthen your faith. I found it very interesting to read. I liked it a lot. I think that there's some things in there that they avoid, some topics that they avoid to deal with economics. So they don't want to ever put anything in the church in a bad light, which is, I think is, that's their point of view. They're trying to see how that's a positive thing for America. And so once you realize that and you read it with that in context, so you can kind of use that as a filter to say, well, maybe I should find out more about this thing. That doesn't sound like it quite is working out the way I said it did. But I find it still be a very good book. It's really worth reading. And there's a lot more things in there that I agree with than anything I don't agree with. It's filling in a lot of gaps that are left out from our public school educations. One of the real regrets of my life is that I was forced to waste 12 years of my life in public schools where I couldn't read the things that were really interesting to me. And I was forced to cover subjects that other people thought were important for me to know. So anyway, those three books were the basis for most of what we're going to talk about tonight. And so let's get on to this, the story about Thanksgiving and how it started. And we're going to start with a sound clip. This is actually a reading out of The Light and Glory. And this is them kind of describing, it's a good introduction to our show tonight, so we're going to play that, and hopefully that will come through okay, and you'll be able to hear. I'm playing it through some speakers here that are near my microphone. Hopefully it will sound okay. So here we go.
On a warm, hazy July morning in 1620, three barges could be seen gliding along a Dutch canal en route from Leiden to the seaport of Delft City. In the distance, across the broad, low fields, a large stone windmill basked in the early morning sun, its huge white sails very turning. It was a morning for tearing, for taking in the fragrance of new mown hay and the muted chirping of field crickets. But there could be no tearing for the congregation on these barges, for a third of them, though, was the beginning of a much longer voyage, a voyage from which there would be no return. One of these was William Bradford, a young, strong, enthusiastic English farmer who was counted among their chief men. He had been with their pastor, John Robinson, from the very beginning in Yorkshire, 14 years before. Barely 16 then, Bradford was an orphan being reared by his uncle in the yeoman tradition of his family. If on that barge that morning in 1620 Bradford recalled those early years, it may have been with a sense of wonder. So much had passed into history since then. He could write it all down one day, many years hence.
Okay, so that was using that as an introduction for the story. That's out of The Light and Glory. A lot of the readings that I'll do today are out of that book. Now, before we start to cover the events that William Bradford recalled in this journal that he ended up documenting all the pilgrimage to the New World, I think it'll help the listeners understand the history of that time and how Bradford came to be standing on that barge in Holland. I mean, these were Englishmen. What were they doing in Holland? That's the first question that kind of popped in my mind as I'm reading this at first. And in the early 17th century, that'd be the late 16th century, life in England was largely a function directed by the Church of England. And you think, well, they had a king. Yeah, they had a king, and the king did the big stuff and did the wars and raised the armies, but the church, they were pretty much in everybody's business on a daily basis. They were telling everybody what to do, how to live. And normally I would say if they're telling them good things, how can that be a bad thing? I think a lot of people could think of that. But it's kind of like with any big bureaucratic organization entrusted with unlimited power over the lives of other people, corruption begins to grow. and a kind of a some anything organization with that kind of power tends to kind of attract corrupt people. This is the same thing that Hayek wrote about in Road to Serfdom. The power, it isn't so, his idea wasn't that, you know, quote, Lord Acton make that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Hayek's idea was more like the power attracts corrupt people like a magnet. So, and I think that's really true. Now, there were two groups of Christians who were opposed to the current system and the corruption within the Church of England. There were probably more than two, but there were two main groups. And you might even say there was one main group and then there was everybody else, but the second group actually had quite a following too. But the first main group, they were dedicated to purifying the church from within. That was kind of their goal. They wanted to grow their ranks, convert other people to their way of thinking, become a dominant force, take over the church, and get rid of the corrupt people. The church really never saw them as a problem or as a threat because they knew who they were. They were able to keep them in kind of in check. They always made sure that any positions of authority they had were really dead-end places where people just spent the rest of their life shuffling paper and doing nothing jobs. And they would never, ever be able to mount serious threat to their positions. So they would mock them, and they, you know, just the way that current groups get mocked by other politicians. They make up names for them instead of dealing with them honestly and their ideas and reforms. Anyway, they started calling them, one of the names that they used to mock them was the Puritans. And the Puritans actually took that as a badge of honor because they were all about purifying the church. So they actually started to call themselves Puritans too, and they became known Puritans. Now, they were not the first ones to come to America. They were still in England trying to purify the church. And there was a second group. And the second group was considered much more dangerous by the church because they wanted to not take over the church and change it. They wanted to leave the church and let the church rot away on its own and really just worship God in their own manner, what you know, point of being, and to pray openly and to worship freely and to kind of to lead themselves in their own version of what Christianity really meant. They said they believed in free prayer, which would tend to leave the bishops out of the picture with respect to everything they now claimed as their responsibility. They were most often called separatists, and they were a distinct minority. They were, however, outside the control of the bishops, and because of this, the bishops kind of feared them. There wasn't anything they could do to pigeonhole them into a place of no power and to keep them silenced. They had to, they had to worry about how much influence are these people gaining, what are they doing, so they would infiltrate their midst. They would spy on them constantly. Some of this sounds familiar, like it's happening right now with our government and things. Yeah, that's true. It is very similar. Anytime they would associate with somebody new, they would then immediately start to check out that new person. They were denied a lot of business opportunities. They were denied. There was kind of a corrupt mercantilist economic system in England at that time, and they were not allowed into that economic system at all. They were barred from it. So anyway, and just reading from my notes here, the separatists were constantly harassed, bullied, assessed, special taxes, sent to prison for no crimes, and in general persecuted at every turn. They sought the protection of going underground and became very secretive in their meetings and associations with each other. Now that the bishops, and you know, and learning that they were, it was getting harder and harder to figure out what these guys were doing, that made the bishops even more nervous. And it made them double down on their efforts, so the scrutiny and the spying and the persecution all intensified. And eventually what they did, the separatists said, we just cannot be here anymore. They're going to, you know, do away with all this. So they left and they sought refuge in Holland. Life in Holland wasn't easy. Just as we have immigrants coming into America from Mexico, they have a rough time getting started. They get the worst jobs. They get the jobs that no one else wants to do. They get the jobs that, you know, pay the least amount of money, that are the hardest physically to do. These weren't necessarily the life that they wanted to lead. Some of these people were pretty able and capable people. They were tradesmen, some of them. They were denied working in their trades because they were immigrants. So they would just work for other people as kind of like a hired hand. They get room and board and a little bit of compensation, not much else. So they didn't have a lot of money. Now, after just kind of describing this situation, I think I want one thing that kind of just jumped into my head was how similar this was to the situation we have presently, political situation we have in the country today. We have a group, and they are they call themselves a Tea Party, taxed enough already, and they're ridiculed and made fun of. From actually Republicans and Democrats alike, that they have their goal, though, is to try and reform the body politic from within the system. They're trying to get their candidates elected that will change the system and make it less corrupt. But I tell them, good luck. I don't think you're going to succeed, because it seems like the system is the one that's corrupting them, or the system attracts corrupt people, even the ones that they could maybe lie to you to get elected or to get your support. But they would be, the modern day Tea Party would be similar in the way that they're being treated, in the way they're trying to operate, the way their strategies for reforming the system were very similar to what the Puritans were trying to do in a religious context. The separatists are very similar to, I would say, our modern day anarchists. Now, before you guys all start jumping on me, or you start thinking, this is not a good analogy. It's probably not a perfect analogy, because the separatists still believed in this, that the supreme ruler of their church was God or Jesus, and they were not willing to live without rules. They were not casting all that away. So that analogy isn't exactly perfect, but they wanted to be ruled by God, the rules of God, not by men. And I think the anarchists today, they want to be ruled under natural laws, natural rights that everybody should enjoy and have the right to rule themselves. So their philosophies aren't that dissimilar. They're very similar, actually. And I think that's probably why you see a lot of people who are associated with kind of anarchism, which, by the way, is not people with Molotov cocktails trying to burn down buildings and stuff. A true anarchist is very peaceful. They believe in non-aggression. The only time they use force is to defend themselves. They aren't violent people. The whole part of their life is to live in harmony with other people. That's what they're trying to do. They just don't want other people to tell them how to live their life. That's probably their only grievance. I'm always reminded of that part of the movie The Princess Bride, where the character goes up and says, "That word you use, I do not think it means what you think it means." Every time someone wrinkles their nose when they hear the word anarchism mentioned. I think anarchism is a beautiful thing. It may be a little idealistic, and maybe it isn't, because I think through history, the times when it has been employed, it's been a very peaceful existence, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. anyway, I saw that as a really a similar comparison, because the present day anarchists, they wish to be self-governing. We live outside laws of authority that they don't consent to. And I think that as there are more and more and more and more laws every day, there's going to be more and more and more and more people who are sympathetic with that reason. They understand that other people are making laws that change their lives, and they don't have any say in it, or any no one asks them for consent. And even if they don't consent, it doesn't seem to matter. But there's a majority of 50% plus one person can put them under some kind of rule that they don't want to be under. So they don't think that that's right. It's not, that violates their natural rights, which I agree, it violates their natural rights. Certainly, the separatists, as it later became known as the Pilgrims, but really I'm going to refer to them mostly as separatists until they get to America. The separatists were persecuted. They had begin to think in this manner, that other men don't have the right to tell us how to pursue our religious happiness. They don't have a right to tell us how to pray. They don't have a right to tell us how to worship. They don't have a right to make us tithe, to build churches and support bishops that tell us how to pray and how to worship. They didn't like all that, and they didn't think it was right. And they really had put a lot of thought. They were kind of developing a sense of anarchistic thought at that point. They thought that they were capable of following God's laws by themselves without any direction from anybody else. Okay, so that's kind of a background on the time. And let's go to our next sound clip here. And this one is going to be, this is just a little further down the road. These guys are on a barge. They're sailing down through the canals to a seaport in Holland. And here we go.
The agreement was that each adult 16 years and older would have one share worth 10 pounds sterling, about $7,100, and another would be outfitted and equipped himself. Those with extra funds could, of course, buy more shares. They would all continue in joint partnership for 7 years, the standard period of indenture, at the end of which time, all land and property would be divided up according to the number of shares. Personal property, such as houses, home lots, gardens, would remain wholly the property of the planters and would not be divided up. The planters were also to be given 2 days a week of their own. It struck them as an eminently fair agreement, so Weston went off to London to confer with his adventurers and to see about hiring a ship to transport them.
Okay, now, the Weston that's being referred to here is Robert Weston, and he was an investor. In those days, they called them adventurers. Today, they might be called entrepreneur. That's what the French would call them. But the English word for that was adventurer. And they were looking for people to more or less give them a charter to set up a colony along the east coast of North America. And they'd been looking for different place, different places in the New World to go. They'd considered going to places where they had discovered gold, but that was in a more tropical area, and they were worried about diseases that their bodies didn't have natural defenses for. And they were also worried that if they had too much wealth, then they would be subject to pirates and looting and armies and wars, and they didn't want to have any part of that. They were content to really go someplace where they had to work hard for what they got. They just wanted to be able to be left in peace and have a life where they could worship as they wanted to. And this Weston, Robert Weston, he sought them out because they had gone to the Virginia colony, and the people running the Virginia colony, they had set up a settlement in Jamestown, 1607. And that wasn't going so well. 80 to 90% of the people that, and the reason I say 80 to 90, so some of the people were never, they never found their bodies. They were assumed dead, but they may have just escaped into the wilderness and gone to live with Indians, and you know, we never heard from them again. And but they were assumed dead. But we don't know for sure. So 80 to 90% of the first group that went to Jamestown died. So that's basically 9 out of 10 people died. So it wasn't going well. There's not a lot of return on investment from dead people. They can't produce much wealth, and the Virginia colony was going bankrupt. And so they told the separatists that they didn't have the money to fund another colony in the North American continent at that time. They wished them well and hoped they could do something. Apparently, Robert Weston heard about this, and he was not as wealthy as the people in the that were in the Virginia company. And so, but he had a group of people, that adventurers, that they did have enough money that they could bankroll setting up a colony over there, and he was sympathetic to their cause, or said he was. Some historians paint him as kind of a con man who had kind of got them to sign on to a deal that was not very good for the separatists, and it was very good for him and his investors. But others say that, you know, it was, they didn't have to sign it and they didn't have to go. And it was a free agreement that was made without anybody holding a gun to anybody else's head. So I think that they knew what they were getting into, and they were still okay with it. Now, maybe it wasn't, they didn't know everything that they were getting into, but that could be said for both sides. And just like any other free exchange or a contract that's written, both parties at the end of, as they consummate the deal, they feel like they're better off than they were before. They're getting what they wanted to get in exchange for something else. So anyway, he provided money for their first, or for their voyage. And what they had to do is they had to acquire some ships. Now, in the descriptions in the historical accounts, they call it purchasing a ship, but they really weren't purchasing the ships. They were purchasing the use of the ships, kind of like renting them or leasing them, and the personnel that are aboard to take, you know, to deal with it. So that they would, the people who owned the ships, the captains and the crews, they would contract with different people to take. It's just like taking cargo, and this is going to be human cargo. And so they contracted for it, for two ships, to take them to the New World. They did not have enough money to take everybody that was in their group. They had about 600 people in their company, people, and they were led by a man named John Robinson, I believe his name. Let's see. Yeah, John Robinson. And there were about 600 there. Now, William Bradford, who we talked about in that first clip I played, he was one of my, I guess you'd call him like an elder in the church, similar to something like that. But he was somebody that, you know, John Robinson relied on to administer things that needed to be administered. He would pass messages on to people like him. And there was, he probably had about, for a group of 600 people, he probably had about 20 or 30 people like that. And so they kind of divided this group up, and they picked out the people that they thought would be first, the ones that wanted to go the most, and the ones they thought would be most suited for that, so they could establish a settlement there, and then the rest of the congregation could join them at a later time. Now, they did all this knowing what had happened in Jamestown. That was common news. They weren't afraid. Didn't have everybody that they needed for this trip. So Robert Weston had gone out and found some other tradesmen that they needed to complete. Now, for instance, it was English law that every ship that sailed had to have a cooper on board. A cooper is someone that makes barrels. And because all their food, their water, everything else was always stored in barrels. The barrels had to be sealed and tight, and if one of them was damaged, they had to be repaired. So that it was really a matter of survival. So there had to be a cooper on board for every ship, and so they needed to have a cooper. There were also blacksmiths and other people that were tradesmen that would help them build
the structures, the infrastructure they needed to have a settlement in the New World. And by and large, these people were not, didn't share their faith exactly. They were more Church of England people, but they were, most of them were least sympathetic to their cause. And certainly the separatists welcomed them and took them in as they were one of their own. So the group that went over wasn't 100% separatists, but they were by far a very large majority of people. But there were a few other people, I would say maybe around 20 people that were non-separatists that were needed to fill in the things that they were missing for their settlement, their colony. They got the two ships. One was a larger 90-ton vessel, and it was called the Mayflower. That's the one we're all familiar with. The other was a smaller ship named the Speedwell. Now, there was only room and money for about a third of the group, and when I say a third of the group, that would be, if there were 600, that would be 200 people. It really wasn't that much. It was more like about 150 people. So the book I was reading, I don't think they really caught on to the fact that they were giving me different statistics in different parts about how many people were actually involved. But I would say a third to a fourth, somewhere in there, on this first voyage. They had room for about 150 people with supplies and things to feed them through the first winter. And what they had done is they had signed contracts that they would pay back this loan over 7 years, and then after 7 years, the things that they had built and the lands that they had put under cultivation would be theirs. It was like an indentured servant contract. And so they were looking forward to that. And they were getting all ready and ready to go. And at the last minute, Robert Weston shows up and he has a new contract that he wants them to sign, which was a little more favorable to Weston and the other adventurers and a little less favorable to the pilgrims. At that point, they were still separatists. They weren't in anarchy yet. And they haven't left the dock. They haven't even got on the ship yet, so they're not pilgrims yet. And then, so there was some consternation about this. They refused to sign it. They had already had a signed agreement. They were going to force Weston to honor that contract. He stormed away. But he did have the ear of one of their group who had been given the authority to sign for the group. And he worked and worked and worked on that guy over the next couple of days until he got him to agree to almost all of the things that he wanted. And then he showed up with a signed document from his people. And they kind of felt betrayed, but because they were still law-abiding people, they just said, well, if that's how it's going to be, that's how it's going to be. And they just got on the ship to go. And I think this is one of the reasons why people portray Weston as kind of a con man or not to be truthful, but really what he was trying to do is he was trying to make this something that he could, if they needed further help in the future, that he would be able to, provide other supplies, maybe some more equipment, some more food, whatever, to keep them going, because he was going to be promised a return on his investment. And basically what it did is it said that the seven-year period was just a guideline, that they were really to work for the benefit of these adventurers that were financing this trip until the loan was paid off. And it was a modest, very small interest rate at first, but it was, depending on what they needed, it could be in their expenses and gaining other funding to supply things that they needed, it could grow. So it was kind of a liability they didn't have any control over, which is, boy, it's like that. Can you say adjustable rate mortgage? It was kind of like that. I think that some people have said that they paid an average over the time they were there somewhere around 18%, which was unheard of in those days. That was on the money that was invested in them and paying it back, they paid back much more. But I think that other people have done the same calculations and come up with the fact that they paid about 1 or 2% more than they borrowed. And so it just depends on how you see how you look at the books. I guess it's like anything else in economics. It's not a precise science. And the accounting was a little bit difficult. Maybe sometimes they padded the books a little bit, what they paid back, I don't know. But for any other, they set sail on August 5th, 1620. Now, I remember that date, August 5th, 1620. And I'm just going to give you a little foreshadowing. The trip across there took approximately 2 months, maybe about 60 days. So you'd expect that sometime on the first part of October, they'd be landing in New England. Or actually, they were headed for Virginia, the Virginia colony. In time, so they could get settled and get something established before winter set in. Okay, but they set sail on the 5th of August. And you'd also think that at that time of year, although it's kind of heading into the storm season, it's not quite there yet. It's still summer and it's still a fairly calm seas. As you get further into the fall, that's hurricane season for the, this is a secret for you people. If you're ever going to go on a cruise and you want to take a chance, you don't have a lot of money, you want to take a chance, you can book Caribbean cruises for not much money during hurricane season, which is kind of a roll of the dice. You might spend a week inside your cabin, while the rain is just, and the ship is pitching around like a cork on it, whatever. But it's, most of the time, you come out way ahead, but some people aren't willing to take that gamble, and the ship's got to keep their cabins full, so they reduce their rates quite a bit at that time. I think this year I was seeing cabins with a veranda for $400 a person, and that's a week in the Caribbean with all your meals included. That's a pretty good deal. Anyway, and this year there were hardly any hurricanes or storms, so it would have been very, very good, unless you happen to be. I think it was 1 week where there was a storm that kind of went through the southern part of the Caribbean. But they were setting forth on August 5th, and they had no sooner got out of port, the Speedwell put up its sails and got under full sail, and the captain was sure it was leaking. He thought they had some problems. They had to turn back. They had put in a new mast for this voyage, and it was a little bit bigger than what it had originally been on the ship. And when the wind had hit the mast, it had put pressure on the timbers below, and it kind of worked those timbers. And they're supposed to have a tight seal between the boards, and so they caulk them with different things in there to keep them from leaking. And he was afraid that the way that the mast was moving when the wind was hitting those sails, that it was going to work those timbers and cause leaks and cause the ship to sink, especially if they were in stormy conditions and things. He just wasn't sure it was seaworthy, so he wanted to come back. So they turned around and came back, and they looked for, the problem was, this is one of those things that when the ship, you only can test it when the ship is under full sail, and you have all the sails furled out there, and the wind is blowing briskly into the sails. That's the only time you can find it. When you take the sails down, and there's no pressure on those timbers, everything kind of tightens back up, and so they could never find any leaks. Some people have speculated the captain of the Speedwell just didn't really have it in his heart to take off and go across the ocean at that time with that ship. He didn't think the further you go into get closer to spring, the calmer the weather is in the Atlantic. And so I think he would be up for it maybe in May or June, but August he was thinking, well, I'm going to have to come back and it's going to be stormy. And so I don't think his heart was in it. He knew what was out there, and he thought that was just too chancy. So he was trying maybe to think of an excuse not to go. But I think he knew about his ship, and he knew what the problem was. And I think it was a legitimate problem. So anyway, they went out again, had the same problem, came back. And they decided that they would then sell their contract with the Speedwell and give it up to somebody else who wanted to use it for other things. And it would be very serviceable for going like from England to Holland or Spain or into the Mediterranean, sailing in there and stuff. Transatlantic voyage probably a little bit out of its class. And they took all their supplies and put them on the Mayflower. And they realized they couldn't get all the people on there, so they thought, well, let's not just pick people. Is there anybody that maybe has changed their mind and they don't want to go? Immediately had 20 people volunteer to stay behind. They had just that brief time of maybe 2 or 3 days out on the open sea with the rolling and pitching of the ships and the seasickness and the filling up and the smells, and it kind of tells people that this is maybe something they weren't willing to endure for 2 months. So they were actually just through volunteering are able to get their numbers down to an amount that would fit on the ship. But in doing so and getting everything removed from the ship, it did use up a lot of time. And now they'd actually wasted a month. And so now they were getting to more of the winter storm season. There's going to be some working a risk, or there's probably going to be some storms. And that's kind of a problem. They're taking something that could be a possibly mostly uneventful journey, and they'd changed the scenario a little bit, and by delaying everything by a month, now they were setting sail in the first week of September instead of in August. And getting across there, it wasn't so much of a sure thing. It was, there's going to be some other things they're going to deal with. Now, they still had 102 people from their original group, which I'm still not sure the exact number of the original group was, but I think it was about 140. So apparently a few more people had been kind of selected to leave other than the original 20 that volunteered, or maybe some other people had volunteered. But one of the things I think is interesting about this is that oftentimes the people that remained behind were parts, you know, like husbands went off and left their wife and children, or husband and wives left and left their children to be raised by other people to, you know, join them later. William Bradford and his wife, Dorothy, they left behind their, they had a son, and they left him behind in care of others while they left for the new world. And so it already they were splitting up families, and I think that they probably reunited some families, seeing that they had more people than they had room for. And they probably also wanted to keep some of the people that were tradesmen that you know, would be able to provide carpentry skills, or even if they weren't separatists, the coopers and the people had blacksmithing skills and could make iron, you know, they could smelt iron and make things out of iron. They needed people like that, so I'm sure they kept those people. And anyway, that's what they had. Now they're finally out to sea. Now at this point, they're kind of separatists slash pilgrims, because they're beginning their pilgrimage. And a pilgrimage, as you know, is just a voyage. They're going from one place to another. And because it's associated with religion, there are many religious pilgrimages in history that people often... even to this day in Poland, which is where my wife is from, every summer people go on a pilgrimage where they walk to the church that Pope John Paul started his first church, where he started his career as a Catholic priest. And they have camping equipment, and they just start hiking down the highways, and they go about 20, 30 miles a day, and they hike for a week or so, and they get there, and they have a kind of like a revival, and then they turn around and hike back. And that they do that every summer. That's a pilgrimage. During the Dark Age, there are several pilgrimages to the Holy Lands. It's a common thing. These pilgrims were making a pilgrimage to establish, to plant their version of what a church should be, in a land where they could worship freely as they wished. So that was their pilgrimage. And here's our next sound clip about them. Hopefully these are making sense. I'm reading these out right out of the book Light and Glory, because I think they really, it's hard to paraphrase, and they said it so well. I said, I'll just read these and record them, and I can just play them. I don't have to worry about fouling up how I read it. I can always re-record it until I get it right. So here it is. This is the next one.
Still another passenger nearly paid with his life for a minor disobedience. A dozen or so days into the storm, John Howland, the servant of John Carver, could no longer stand the stench of the crowded twin decks. The captain, Elder Brewster, and his own master had each forbade him from going topside. But if he didn't get a breath of fresh air soon, well, finally he decided that he was going to get it. And so up he climbed and out onto the sea-swept main deck. It was like a nightmare outside. The seas around him were mountainous. He had never seen anything like it. Huge, boiling, gray-green waves lifting and tossing the small ship in their midst. Dark clouds roiling the horizon and the wind shrieking through the rigging. Hallen shuddered, and it was not from the icy blast of fresh air that hit him. Just then the ship seemed to literally drop out from beneath him. It was there, and then it wasn't. And the next thing he knew, he was falling. He hit the water, which was so cold that it was like being smashed between two huge blocks of ice. Instantly stunned, his last conscious act was to blindly reach out. And by God's grace, the ship at that moment was heeled so far over that the lines from her spars were trailing in the water. One of these happened to snake across his wrist, and he closed on it and instinctively hung on. According to the U.S. Navy, a man can stand immersion in the North Atlantic in November for about 4 minutes. There's no telling how long Howland was in the sea, how soon someone spotted him and raised the alarm. When they hauled him aboard, he was blue, but he recovered, though he was sick for several days, and he never again stuck his head above deck until he was invited to do so.
Okay, so that's an individual story from their passing. All in all, they were at sea for 66 days. They arrived at Cape Cod on November 11, 1620. So imagine 66 days at sea, and they traveled in an area that was kind of between decks. They had the top deck is where all the stuff is, it's what you see in a movie. So people running around the top deck, they're hoisting sails and putting down and securing ropes, and water is washing across, and everything on the top deck, they have the hatches, those are all sealed, so when water runs across it, it doesn't leak down into the ship, it'll sink it. And then they had a bottom deck, under decks, where they have all their cargo stored, and in between those two, they have like an area where people could, I guess, be boarded for the trip over. And these people were in that area, and they were in an area approximately the size of a volleyball court. So if you've ever been to a volleyball game or you were in school and you played volleyball, that's about how big they were. There were 102 people, and they were seated in chairs and benches in an area about the size of a volleyball court. Now, keep in mind, 66 days, there really is no place to wash. I think there's a place where they can kind of like, get rid of their bodily waste, kind of out the side of the ship or something. But they had their body orders, and there was no place to wash. They couldn't do us there. For whatever, humans kind of smell after a day or two. And this was 66 days, and you can imagine how bad it smelled them down there. All these human orders. There were probably also a few animals along with them, maybe some chickens or something. I don't know. They may not have had any live animals. There certainly was food that they had to eat and things like this, and some of it may have rotted. Still, they would have to eat it. And sometimes people would be sick, seasick, whatever, they would throw up, and there would be the smell of the throw up. 66 days of that. I don't think I could have lasted 66 seconds. Something like that. 66 days is amazing. It's also amazing that none of them died. There were two fatalities on this trip. They were both sailors. One of them was a sailor that had kind of been picking on them and teasing them and bad-mouthing them from the time they stepped on board the ship, and he just didn't have a nice thing to say about them. And about midway through the trip, he was just struck down by a very high fever and died within 24 hours. And I think maybe some of the separatists looked at that as an act of God, although I think it's probably just a coincidence. But I'm sure that there were a lot of other people that were there. The other sailors, seeing that this guy who was the main antagonist of the pilgrims, he got sick and died, and they're kind of superstitious lot. And after that happened, they were much better. They had much better treatment from all the sailors and captain. They just had a better, it was a better journey, a better